This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 277 was recorded on June 24th, 2021. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better meet the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Abra Silver Resource Corporation, a premier emerging silver and gold exploration company, ticker ABRA on TSX Venture and ABBRF in the United States. Daniel LaCalle is back as this week's feature interview guest. Daniel says inflation is coming, but he doesn't worry about it running away or becoming a major economic challenge. We'll also explore Daniel's thoughts on both cryptocurrency and sovereign digital currencies and much more. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview when Patrick's chart deck is titled Post-FOMC Post-Mortem.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's get to that S&P 500. Obviously, a quick sell-off that happened right at the tail end of last week stopped right at its moving averages. And here we are, pretty much almost making a 52-week new high. It seems so much more of the same. Anything new on your views on the S&P?
Well, Patrick, if I just look at the chart, what I see in the technicals is all of a sudden the stochastics are really taking a nosedive. But still, if I look at the tape action, we're down to the 34-day moving average. Big deal. Every dip is being bought here in this bull market. I am absolutely persuaded by the argument that these valuations are crazy and this market is nuts and it ought to crash. But you know what? I was saying that before anybody else. And I was wrong 5 years ago when I said that, and 4 years ago, and 3 years ago. I'm quite convinced now that the trend is up. The fact that I don't think that makes sense does not change that the trend is up, and it's going to continue being up until something changes it. Of course, now that I said that so vehemently, that means the market's going to crash tomorrow and I'll look like an idiot, but we'll see what happens.
Okay.
I'm sticking with it. That's what I feel.
All right, Eric. Well, we could put up some charts on that in the post game, but let's move on to the U.S. dollar index, which obviously had quite the reversal in the post-FOMC and gave it a little bit back this week. But overall, we're hovering around this 92 handle on the dollar index. Do you think this is a trend change or just a short-term noise?
No, I think it's all noise. And the reason I say that, Patrick, you know, when this first backing up of interest rates first started, I said on Macro Voices, look, folks, what's going on is everybody's trying to make sense of a new situation that we haven't had before. The Federal Reserve is going to be printing a huge amount of new debt to finance an insane amount of government borrowing. That ought to be bearish for the bond market until you consider the reflexivity, which says the Fed is likely going to be doing a lot of that buying of those treasury bonds. And, you know, it's going to be more of an intervention story. So this whole what's going on with the dollar, as far as I'm concerned, is a series of panic knee-jerk reactions as everybody tries to figure out what the combination of a macro environment that would normally promote much higher bond yields means in an environment where the policy is not at all towards higher bond yields, but lower bond yields. What does that mean for the currency when it's the reserve currency of the world? Nobody friggin' knows. That's what's really going on. And that's the reason we see all this noise in the market. And we try to make up stories that make sense in the short term. But the big picture here, I'm convinced, is nobody knows because this is a really complex, unusual situation. And I think it's all noise until we get a break below 89, or I don't even know what the number is on the north side. It's probably at least 94, but it would have to be a really high number to convince me that there's a real uptrend in play. I think we're consolidating in uncertainty.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil because it's interesting because most of the commodity markets have turned. In the post-FOMC, a lot of these commodities have dropped, but crude oil continues to make 52-week highs. I mean, we punched north of 74 on an intraday basis. We're trading around 73 in spot 14 at the time of recording. Do you think this continues? Are we still piloting toward $80 or has your view on oil changed?
my view has not changed in the direction you're implying. If anything, I think that we've gotten so far so fast. You know, it's almost $75, and we're barely through the first half of June yet. Well, I guess it's past the first half of June. We're in the final quarter of June now. Hey, it's spring. We haven't even gotten to summer yet. We just had a really, really epic event in the time spreads at the front end of the curve. Now, this is fairly complex stuff that usually only oil traders really understand, so I don't want to spend a lot of time on it for two reasons. Number one, it's fairly complex. Number two, I have no friggin' clue what's going on. Nobody can figure it out because these dislocations in the market normally occur when there is a physical supply interruption, a pipeline spill, something like that into Cushing, blows up the spreads at the front end of the curve. The other thing that will do it is a war or something where people are just afraid that all of a sudden the oil supply is going to dry up. This happened with no apparent explanation, and now it's reversing, and I don't know why, but at some point when we figure it out, we'll cover that. What it says to me is there's a lot of uncertainty in the market, and I think there's plenty of room for a lot more backwardation and a lot higher prices, and maybe 90 is even a low number before this year is out, is what I'm starting to feel. On the other hand, this Delta Plus COVID thing is real. So I think the pandemic's going to get worse. Does that reduce demand? Because, hey, look what happened last time. Or is it totally different because now the world has changed to the point where the public sentiment is such that they're going to say, hey, it's unsafe to travel and we're going to reopen the economy anyway because it's just been too long. We need to get the economy open. That's my base case. I think that's what happens. We open, whether there's Delta Plus or Delta Plus Plus Plus. I think that the pandemic will get better, but that we will continue with vaccination to reopen travel. And that means that oil demand goes through the roof. And you know, I think the upside this summer could be really big. On the other hand, if I got that wrong about the COVID stuff and it really does damage demand, it's a whole different story. It's going to change things. For that reason, I am beginning to hedge some of my very large long exposure, but it's hedge. I still think it's headed upside. I'm just protecting a little bit more for a significant correction if the Delta Plus strain of COVID turns out to be worse than I thought.
Eric, how did the inventory numbers come in for oil?
Well, Patrick, it's another big drawdown on crude oil inventory. 7.6 million barrels would be 8.2 if you include the small draw from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down 1.8 million barrels. Gasoline, drawing down 2.9 million barrels. Distillates is the only build on the board at 1.75 million barrels added to inventory on distillates. Big picture here, Patrick, on inventory. Okay, we've seen a couple of big draws in a row. I think the big series of summer inventory draws that's going to push prices higher and dramatically steepen backwardation is upon us. Okay, that's the prediction, is if these 7 or 8 million barrels a week continue through the summer, that's my scenario where I'm saying prices are going higher than even Goldman is predicting. If I've got that wrong, it's a totally different story, obviously. So we got to continue to watch those. I'm actually reading some analysts that are saying they expect in the month of August alone, there could be more than 100 million barrels drawn out of inventory in the U.S. If that prediction, it's not my prediction, it's somebody else. If the prognostication of 100 million barrels being drawn out in 1 month is actually real, I guarantee you backwardation is going to be screaming by the time we get to the end of August. So I think this summer is going to be really interesting, but the big wild card is we don't know about the Delta Plus strain and what it means for demand.
All right, let's move on to gold, because gold really did get hammered pretty hard in the post-FOMC hawkish tilt. And we dropped down to like the 1760 area on the downside. And really, gold has not been able to even get a bounce off of these lows. We've been just consolidating sideways since. I mean, in your mind, has anything changed in gold?
You know, the answer is almost the same as what I said for the dollar index. The way I see this is gold took an absolute body slam. Why? Because the FOMC made a statement that sort of alluded to an intention they might have in the future to do something that nobody's even sure about what it would mean anyway. The market is panicking because everybody knows that if there is even the appearance of dramatically increasing real yields, that's going to tank the gold market. And my answer to that is, oh gosh, I sure hope so. Because if you stop and actually think about this stuff, you can see very clearly what's happening here, Patrick. The reason that we might be in a situation where the Fed is going to do exactly that and you know, taper and so forth, it's going to create a situation that eventually leads to more stimulus and more bailouts and more so forth. If you think the Fed's got this all under control, they're going to taper, they're going to reduce their balance sheet back down to what it was pre-2008, and everything's going to go fine with no bumps in the night through that process, then for God's sake, sell your gold, because your gold is going to zero. But you know what? I'm willing to bet that's not going to happen. I think the government's going to keep acting like the government, and any weakness in gold prices that comes out of fear associated with maybe there's going to be some tapering or tightening, it's just an opportunity to buy at a better price, is the way that I see it. So I love this drop. I haven't bought more yet because I'm crossing my fingers for an even deeper drop. I did actually buy some more EQX, which was a Marin Katusa recommendation, but it was an old one. I'm not getting it out of his current newsletter, so I don't think his paying subscribers will be offended. Equinox below $8, I think, is a bargain here. But really, I'm hoping that we continue to have people freak out for no good reason, and it pushes gold prices lower, so I can buy even more.
All right, let's finally touch on those 10-year Treasury yields, because obviously yields in general, well, at least the shape of the curve dynamically changed in the post-FOMC, but really we're hovering around 1.50 right now, and there doesn't seem to be much direction other than consolidation for the last couple months. What's your thoughts on yields here?
Well, the way I read the yield tape in general is basically nobody cares until it starts to approach 1.75%, at which point everybody freaks out and jumps out of buildings as if the sky was falling. I think the way to look at this is we haven't had any threats of getting back close to that panic number of 1.75 for a few weeks here. So everybody is getting comfortable. If it stays that way, they'll get more comfortable. If that comfort turns into complacency, maybe it sets us up to go the other way. Right now, what I'm feeling like is probably the, oh my gosh, if the Biden administration spends lots of money, surely that could only mean that bond yields have to go up. That thinking, that mentality has finally evolved to where people thought it through to what we told you on Macro Voices as soon as that announcement came out, which is, look, it's first going to have this reaction until people think it through and realize the long-term implications, and then they're going to see that inflation is coming, guys. At the end of the day, Patrick, I think as long as we're below 1.7 and nobody's panicking, we kind of stay in this consolidation zone. I don't see any reason to expect substantially higher or substantially lower yields anytime soon. But frankly, I'm not following that carefully. The only thing I really worry about is if it goes back over 1.75, I get concerned about everybody freaking out for no good reason again.
Well, this week's feature interview guest is Daniel Lecaille. Now, Eric, why did we invite Daniel back on the show this week?
Well, Daniel is a brilliant macro thinker. He wrote a book with Diego Padilla a few years ago. Energy guy, very smart outlook on a lot of things. And he's also in Europe and kind of has that perspective of, you know, the ECB's role in the global monetary policy equation and so forth. So I wanted to get another European perspective. It's also been, I think it's been more than a year since we've had Daniel on the show. So it was just overdue. Super smart guy.
Eric's interview with Daniel is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Abex Technologies. In addition to sponsoring Macro Voices, Abex also produces Smarter Markets, a weekly podcast that airs every Saturday morning on all the major podcast platforms. Smarter Markets brings together the leading minds in macroeconomics, technology, and commodities to explore how capital markets can be redesigned to better serve market participants and society as a whole. Michelle Dennity's five-part series about the role of digital innovation in advancing the ESG economy is live now at smartermarketspod.com, and you can look for another terrific interview every Saturday morning. But you won't get Smarter Markets on your Macro Voices feed. You have to subscribe separately to Smarter Markets in your podcast app in order to listen to this free podcast.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Daniel Lacaille, fund manager for Tresis Asset Management. Daniel, it's great to have you back on the show. It's been too long. I've been asking everybody about inflation. A lot of people, myself included, think maybe this is the beginning of a secular inflation. Of course, Janet assures us it's just transitory. What do you think?
Thank you very much, Eric. Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure. I don't think that inflation is transitory. More importantly, I think that perceived inflation, what you and I, what our listeners do see in terms of inflationary pressures, are not going away anytime soon because it was a trend that already existed before COVID-19. The Fed always, the Fed and central banks, always look at inflation thinking that it's transitory, that it's going to be, that it's because of supply chain disruptions, etc. But when you look at the components, what you see is that, for example, we are seeing many commodities and many metals in which there is ample capacity, in fact, overcapacity, like, for example, aluminum going through the roof anyhow. And we're seeing that the food prices and the food price index that the FAO publishes reaching new highs that were already reached before COVID-19. So, you know, the first question that we need to ask central banks is what do they measure as transitory? 1 year, 2 years, 3 years? And the second thing that we need to ask central banks is, are you really taking into account all the inflationary pressures? Because they're not taking into account house prices. They're not taking into account, in some developed economies, taxes, for example, in utility bills, etc. So I think that the inflationary pressures that we have seen throughout the recovery are more sticky than what many would fear.
Let's talk about the recovery itself then, because, you know, on the one hand, it seems like maybe we've got a significant risk of this Delta strain and the continuing mutation of this virus. Maybe it's going to be worse than we thought. But I'll make a prediction of my own, Daniel, which is I think that maybe even if it is worse than we thought, I think public sentiment has shifted to open the economy, period, whether it's safe or not. It's too much time to open the economy. If I'm right, I think that's going to lead to a lot more tension between different people. Some people, of course, feel that we shouldn't have closed the economy ever. Some people, you know, think it should stay closed. I think that tension is going to get greater, and I can't decide what it's going to mean for demand, because I think the economy does continue, but I think that the pandemic is going to continue too. Well, how do we make sense of this?
I think you're absolutely right. First, if we look at the history of pandemics, we know that there is always a second wave. And one of the mistakes that many people have made in the first part of last year was to believe that we had two waves of the pandemic, even three, in 2020. That was a mistake. It was all the same. And now what we're seeing is, what, as you very well mentioned, a number of variants that so far are impacting the not so developed economies or the emerging economies, but they're gradually reaching some of the most important economies in the world. And what we know from the first wave is that markets and governments don't truly react until it reaches the developed economies. Even when it reached Italy or Spain, reaction was still very subdued. So what I do agree with you is, and I think it's that the mentality of the population has shifted. Having severe lockdowns for 12, 16 months in many cases has led to many people, the vast majority of the population, I would say, in developed economies, to say absolutely that they will not tolerate drastic lockdowns as a measure that has, by the way, proven to be extremely ineffective. France implemented very severe lockdowns with 150 cases per 100,000 inhabitants and maintained those lockdowns and with 500 cases. Huh? So what we need to do is basically to understand that it's going to be very difficult politically for governments to justify the severity of the lockdowns that we have seen in the past. What I think is that the same way that we saw a dramatic, let's say, easing of the exuberance post the third quarter of last year, we will likely witness a similar situation in the fourth quarter of 2021, probably in the third quarter itself. Once the sugar high of the reopening, of the desire of the population to spend and to enjoy life outdoors, etc., fades away, it is true that people tend to be significantly more conservative about their purchasing and investment decisions afterwards. And the virus, coming back to the point that you were saying, that you were mentioning, the virus is very seasonal. So we all remember that last summer, the situation in general seemed to be completely under control and fantastically improved. And then we saw that the cases started to ramp up throughout autumn, beginning of winter. So, you know, I would be extremely cautious about this tendency that we're seeing in consensus to replicate the reopening effect and the base effect that we're living right now in the economy throughout the third, fourth quarter, let alone 2022.
I wanted to start with that framework, Daniel, before moving on to talk about the central bank policy trend, which at least in terms of the lip service that they give it is all turning to tapering. Now, help me understand this. We're probably going to have the pandemic get worse, and there's going to be a lot of discontentment and disagreement among people in society about that. And there's going to be more health issues and more government spending. And that's going to be the reason that central banks don't need to keep printing money and it's okay to taper? I'm missing the logic. What's going on here?
You're not missing the logic. The tapering debate is completely nonsensical. There's not going to be any tapering. Either you believe in a robust recovery with healthy inflation and strong jobs recovery, which will inevitably not lead to tapering, but to the end of stimulus and therefore a very significant impact on financial assets, or you believe in what is most likely to happen, which is that the recovery will be weak, as it has been in every recovery since 1975, by the way, weaker levels of growth, weaker levels of productivity growth, and with it, real wages, weaker levels of recovery of employment. We have to remember that with a massive reopening and GDP estimates being revised upwards by 30, 40%, the employment picture remains pretty similar to the pre-review estimates. So I think that it's very, very unlikely that central banks end up tapering. And that's why the Fed is mentioning 2023. 2023 first is probably not even the members that are currently in the Fed will be there, or at least half of them. But the other element about it is that if the picture of the economy that the Fed paints is correct, then tapering will be faster, and that is unlikely to happen. And if the economy remains relatively weak, very indebted, deficit spending continues to be very significant, it is virtually impossible to believe in tapering. Sovereign issuers would not be able to sustain or to accept that level of increase in borrowing costs.
Are we at a point yet where we have to worry about all of this money printing really starting to get to not just the secular inflation I see coming, but a true runaway inflation where it's beyond the ability of central bankers to control it?
I don't think we're going to see runaway inflation. I think that the disinflationary pressures that existed before COVID-19 remain. Aging of the population in developed economies, very high levels of debt, very high levels of government spending, which are deflationary in principle, and the advance of technology. All of those elements are disinflationary and put a little bit of a brake on runaway inflation. Think about what type of inflation the world would have and developed economies would have if those pressures did not exist. Now, that doesn't mean that the things that matter in our day-to-day spending for our families, utilities, food, healthcare, education, the things that truly generate our concerns about affordability of the cost of living, those things are not only rising in a period of recovery, they were already rising as well in a period of so-called crisis. So that's why I'm concerned about inflation and inflationary pressures in general, but not runaway inflation or hyperinflation.
Daniel, as we look forward through this recovery and, you know, into what comes next after the pandemic, it seems that ESG, environmental, social, and corporate governance aware investing, is really becoming a big trend. And I got to tell you, I don't think there is anything more noble or a better cause that I've ever heard of in my life than the owners of capital taking responsibility for seeing that it's used responsibly to make the world a better place. So I want to make sure that I am crystal clear that I'm very much in favor of the concept. But frankly, I think this ESG trend on Wall Street is all about separating people from their money and has almost nothing to do with environment, society, or governance. What do you make of this ESG stuff, Daniel?
I think that you have said it perfectly. We all are 100%, and me the first as well, no, in favor of capital allocators taking responsibility and being conscious about the environment, about social issues, about corporate governance. And this is a trend. And this is important to understand as well. This is a trend that has been going for decades. Mm-hmm. I remember when I started in the buy side at Citadel that we had, you know, environmentally conscious and activist policies towards investments, etc., all of those things. So environmental, social, and corporate governance action is something that we all agree with, and that is a trend that is absolutely unstoppable. Now, we have to discern between the trend and the improvement in the view about stakeholder capitalism that Wall Street might be taking, relative to and compared with the this fashion about putting an ESG label on almost anything. To the point that, for example, you can see some of the ETFs that are so-called ESG or socially responsible investments and see that they're mostly comprised of energy companies, no? And oil and gas companies. There are some of them there that you can see out there. And the other thing that we need to understand is that the idea of ESG and socially conscious capitalism and the idea of socially responsible investment and sustainability is that there is nothing that is more sustainable than a profit-based economy. So when the first thing that we need to understand as investors is that there's no sustainability without profit, and that trying to make investors think that an unprofitable and weak business idea is going to be sort of a great investment and reach high valuations simply because it has the ESG label is a huge mistake. So you have to be extremely careful about the use of a label in which, in many cases, what investment banks or brokerage houses are using that label is to try to disguise unprofitable and very weak businesses. that one thing has to be made very clear is that what everyone that truly understands socially responsible investment is looking at is for businesses that generate good profits, good cash flows, and good margins to retain and increase those profits, cash flows, and margins with a socially and environmentally sound policy, but not to make something that is unprofitable and probably obsolete simply acceptable as an investment because it uses the label green or SRI or ESG. We all remember the wave of bankruptcies in solar companies. Now, there was this big fashion about everything that had the renewable label as something that was going to be rising in value in the stock market all the time. But the reality showed that when you had a bad business that was extremely levered and had weak margins and that depended too much on increased debt, it ended up going bankrupt anyhow. No? So the same way that being environmentally conscious, that focusing on renewables, that liking the technology is one thing, and looking at any renewable stock is a completely different thing, we have to do exactly that same exercise with the label of ESG. We have to remember that bubbles do not persist if it's based on basically just marketing. What we need to understand is that companies that are conducting their businesses in an environmentally, social, and good corporate governance framework will perform better, and they do perform better, but only when they're profitable and when they have a good long-term strategy.
Let's talk about some of those environmentally related investment opportunities and where the markets are, because I think a lot of people now are looking at energy markets saying, okay, here we are at $73 and change as we're speaking on Wednesday. And it seems like we've come awfully far, awfully fast. If you believe the secular inflation narrative, as I do, you can make an argument for much higher oil prices, over 100. It's also a pretty good argument for they're already way too far and need to retrace back down to a fair value. What do you make of energy markets and where are we headed?
I think that we have seen the effect of three things in energy markets. The first is that despite the reopening and the improvement of demand, supply cuts have remained exactly the same way as they were when the market was flooded with oil. No? So the market has tightened very quickly, but supply cuts remain. And when we analyze the oil market, we need to always have in mind that there is a significant level of capacity, productive capacity out there that is idle because of a conscious decision of OPEC and its partners. So oil prices may go higher because of the reopening, increased demand, the monetary factor. Obviously, when you have increased money supply growth, there's more liquidity going to scarce assets. And the fact that these were parts of the financial asset basket that were heavily underweight by investors, therefore simply moving to equal weight, has generated a significant inflation in prices. Those things might persist. What I think is that we also have to look at the risk to the economy. Oil price impact on the economy is not necessarily because it goes up, but how quickly it goes up relative to the economy. And for example, if we look at oil prices, they're up about 40-odd% year to date. That is creating already tensions in terms of disposable income, in terms of consumption, etc. So I think that the energy market is very tight right now, that two things, a change in OPEC supply cuts and an agreement with Iran might alleviate that tightness, but not necessarily entirely, because the monetary and the financial asset perspective that I mentioned remain. But we need to understand that, remember in 2008, when oil prices went through the roof, they reached 120, 130, I think that they touched, is that if they go up too fast, what they also do is to hinder the prospects of the economic recovery, and they can actually generate a significant impact in terms of the of expectations of growth, consumption, and investment. I also think that from the perspective of energy prices, we need to be at least aware of the fact that with all this push from the IEA, from investors and some of the energy companies to do something which I find absolutely outrageous now, which is to say that there needs to be no more capital expenditure increases in the sector, might generate a very big problem in the economy and lead to stagflation the way that we lived in the 70s. Is that we can have a situation by which abruptly impacting capital expenditure in the energy sector leads to a very negative effect on the economy. One thing is to believe, as I do firmly, in energy transition driven by competition, by technology, diversification, and the technology advances. And another completely different thing is to be too ideological and to force companies to stop investing in things that we need every day, as we do, way before the transition and the, at least, the ability of the market to substitute technologies is fully implemented. So that I'm concerned about. I see that the level of CapEx in energy companies is not just going down too fast, is that at the same time, it is going down in the things, in the areas in which there are the higher levels of bottlenecks, whilst these energy companies, in order to give, and I go back to the ESG situation, to give an image of green energy, etc., the part in which they're increasing investment is not enough to offset the negative impact that can be created by a CapEx slump in the energy sector. I'm very, very concerned about being too ideological and too quick to say. I thought that the IEA message of no need for more capital expenditure in oil and gas was not just empirically wrong, but extremely dangerous.
I want to move on now to another trend that I think is going to be important, which is the market needs to come to terms with digital currency. And, you know, back a few years ago when crypto was first getting popular, I used to tell people, I said, look, if you really love this digital currency stuff, just wait till central banks get their hands on this technology. Because when they do, they're not going to have the same goals that Satoshi had. And the prediction I made almost 10 years ago now, I'm not that quite that long, maybe 8 years ago, was I said, what began as a libertarian pipe dream is going to end as an Orwellian nightmare when central banks completely re-engineer money itself using digital currency technology. I guess I'm the only one who's really convinced that's the risk. What do you think of that? And more importantly, you know, that's just my take, broader spectrum. Where's this whole thing headed? Started with crypto, now CBDCs are coming in. Where are we headed with digital currency?
I think your prediction 8 years ago was spot on. We cannot.
Nobody seems to be worried about the Orwellian nightmare, though. I don't get it.
It's very interesting how naive investors can be and economists.
ESG. Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
It's very, very surprising how naive investors can be when you have the facts that central bank independence has all but gone out the window. central bank independence doesn't exist. Central banks have maintained very aggressive expansionary policies in growth periods with record levels of employment because of political interference. Central banks have been maintaining financial repression at any cost in all types of economic environments. And you truly believe that central banks are going to implement a digital currency without any of the secondary negative effects? That's being extremely naive. The biggest risk of central bank digital currency, to start with, we already know, is that it's surveillance disguised as currency. Is that you are giving all the power to central banks that have been at least questionable in their independence to know exactly what you pay, what you invest, what you save, which you're giving all the power to those central banks to wipe out your savings when they believe that savings are too high. You are giving them all the power to elevate money supply without the limiting and factor and the break that the credit mechanism implies in monetary policy. Because today, the reason why we may still have a debate about why quantitative easing was not massively inflationary in prices, the entire difference, the entire reason why quantitative easing is not as inflationary as direct money printing, Argentina style, is because the mechanism of transmission of monetary policy is driven by demand of credit. And if credit demand doesn't go up, then that whole process is eliminating the risk of massive inflationary pressures in goods and services prices. Now, think for a second, if you eliminate the transmission mechanism and the intermediation in which demand works as a brake for the increase of supply of money. It's you know, the limit is endless. Central banks can decide, central banks and governments can decide how and where to increase money supply. They can decide who gets, in a way, penalized for being a bad citizen, who gets some kind of a reward for being a good citizen. It's very dangerous to give entities that have not, that had proven not to be fully independent, a further and higher control of the money supply. So, you know, those are important risks that we need to talk about. We can talk about the benefits. The benefits are obviously, you know, transparency, quicker access, but you don't need to have a central bank digital currency to achieve those benefits. So we need to discuss those important negatives. And you mentioned one thing that I think is critical. The libertarian idea of a cryptocurrency might never be fully implemented because what we at the same time are allowing is a level of control of the monetary system of central banks and governments that every time that cryptocurrencies become not even a threat to the monetary system, but a mild headline, they can immediately implement measures to ban them, to put limits to their utilization, etc. But at the same time, the central bank of the major, especially the central banks of the major economies and governments, do look at cryptocurrencies and think, what a great way to, quote-unquote, improve the transmission mechanism of monetary policy. When central banks say that a central bank digital currency will improve the mechanism of the transmission mechanism of monetary policy, what they're basically saying is that they will be able to generate more and more persistent inflation quicker and without any control.
Oh, and it's worse than that. I mean, as I described in my book 3 years ago, the central bankers haven't even begun to figure out how much opportunity this technology affords to create new super-duper powerful central banking tools that I, for one, do not advocate central bankers or anyone else having. But the technology has been invented, and once it's been invented, somebody usually ends up using it. So, yeah. I want to actually react to something you said in the beginning of your response there, Daniel, because to paraphrase, I think you said something like, you know, your biggest fear or the worst thing that could go wrong would be with all this digital currency technology would be governments getting a hold of it and using it in a way that has too much of a burden or impairs the individual rights to privacy of individuals and so forth. That's exactly what I used to think myself when I wrote my book. That's exactly what I said about this. I've changed my mind. I think that that's actually the second worst risk. I think the worst risk, you know, governments, if for all of their failures, they're big and bureaucratic and slow moving. So they don't do damage all that quickly. They just do a lot of damage. On the other hand, Silicon Valley, the industry that I came from, software, is already out of control with how much power it has over the world. Facebook literally affects the outcome of elections all over the world. You know, there is a problem with power and society in Silicon Valley having too much of it. And frankly, there are people that are smart enough to design systems of a whole new way for money to work that would be cool, that would be engaging, that would make people want to use it because it's simple and easy and it's just drag and drop simplicity on your phone or tablet or whatever. And what you don't really realize because it's kind of hidden underneath the veneer is, guess what? Actually, Silicon Valley is engineering a way to really create a power structure for the designers of those currency systems, which gives them the power of a government themselves. I think that, and the thing is, unlike the government central bank digital currency thing, they're going to screw it up for the first 10 years because they screw everything up for 10 years because they're governments. The Silicon Valley boys know what they're doing. They know how to do damage. And I think it's a much bigger risk. Libra got shut down, but it's trying to make a comeback. There will be more. I think a Silicon Valley digital currency that tries to somehow kind of win public support and take over the world is a very real risk. And I don't think it could be stopped once it got to a certain point.
That is a great point that I actually had not thought about. Because a central bank digital currency controlled by governments, be it because people understand that there's no real independence of the central bank, or because it's even widely known, will always have a certain level of suspicion from citizens. Completely agree with that. That is a truly a great point. However, a very easy to use tool in a mobile phone that is cool and at the same time attracts a younger audience, etc., that is a much more, at the same time, attractive but also dangerous proposition if badly used. So I actually kind of agree that that could be an important risk. I think that if I may, as we think about this subject, look at a sort of in a sort of devil's advocate way, I would think that right now technology giants depend too much on central bank action and on central bank loose monetary policy to destroy the power of central banks and their monetary policy.
Daniel, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. But before I let you go, I want to talk about your YouTube channel, which is Daniel Lacalle, or if you're an English speaker, Daniel Lacalle. Does it automatically sense which way you pronounce it and speak to you in English or Spanish? Do you have that feature?
Well, if you say it, it immediately finds me. I don't think it's, even if you misspell it, you will find it quite easily. And there's two channels, one in Spanish and one in English. Daniel Lacalle in English is the name of the English channel to make it simple and easy. And that's where you're going to find all of my videos with my comments about the economy, conversations with different people, and the latest conferences that I give.
Well, we'll look forward to getting you back on the show in a few months for another update. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor. Looking for exposure to rising silver and gold prices? Abra Silver Resource Corporation, ticker ABRA on the TSX Venture Exchange and ABBRF in the United States, is rapidly emerging as one of the premier silver and gold-focused exploration companies. Abra Silver has an advanced stage project with a large resource base of over 140 million ounces on a silver equivalent basis and continues to announce several very high-grade silver and gold drill results, with more results still pending. Abra Silver is very well-funded with a strong shareholder base and excellent exploration upside potential. You can find a link to the latest press release in the Research Roundup email. Visit abrasilver.com for more information. That's abrasilver.com for more information on this silver and gold exploration stock.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Daniel back on the show. What did you take away from the interview?
Patrick, my thinking about inflation has evolved in the following way as a result of the series of interviews that we've done with Daniel and a lot of other guests. The question that was on my mind is, okay, are we looking at a coming impending secular inflation, big deal inflation, like late 1960s, early 1970s? Are we going through that again? And I wanted to ask the people that are smarter than I am in the macro world that. I've now asked a lot of really smart people that. My conclusion is, yes, secular inflation is certainly my base case. Everybody gets something wrong. Maybe I'll get this one wrong. I really think it is a major decadal, you know, we're headed for another 1970s worth of inflation. Question is, in the 1970s, that stagflation was a major economic dislocation event that changed the world. It completely changed everything. Daniel's saying in this interview, yeah, don't see that happening again. This inflation's not going to be the problematic kind. Okay, I'm not smart enough to know who's right, but I am smart enough to know that that's the operative question. We don't know for sure that there's going to be a secular inflation, but that's my base case. That's what I'm banking on. That's what I'm betting on. Now the question is it ever going to run away to the point where it's out of control and we get into a late 1970s pre-Paul Volcker situation where everybody's actually starting to fear hyperinflation? Or are we really going to have a risk of that? Or is the underlying deflationary backdrop that started before all of this enough to offset it, as Daniel's suggesting? Logically, that makes plenty of sense, Patrick. But guess what? Take a look at your history of all the major inflations throughout history, including the Weimar inflation, the hyperinflation in the Weimar Republic. Those all were preceded by whiffs of very strong deflation just before the major inflation took off as a result of, drum roll please, excessive policy reaction from the government to the deflationary backdrop that existed at the time. We do have the ingredients in place for a major runaway inflation. I'm not smart enough to know whether that runaway risk is a real risk or just be reading too much Zero Hedge. So I'm going to find out by asking lots more smart people in coming weeks. Right now, though, let's move on to the post-game chart deck, which this week is titled Post-FOMC Post-Mortem. Registered users, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email in your inbox, that means you haven't yet signed up for a completely free account at macrovoices.com, which you can do by going to our homepage and clicking the red button that says looking for the downloads. Patrick, we're looking on page two here at the S&P continuous chart with the 50-day moving average under it. What's going on?
Well, we were in the last couple of weeks and going into the FOMC in the quad witch and gamma pin period where volatility is compressed and we had these average 20-day S&P point ranges for high lows. And really, things were quiet. And one of the themes was that in the post-quad witching roll-off that the volatility would return. The question we were trying to ask, though, would that volatility be some big move to the downside or simply finally a market that's unpinned to continue a trend higher? And what's interesting is that we started that Friday with a quick drop that followed the textbook drops that we have seen in the last 6 months, which is it consolidates down to an average point, in this case, the 50-day moving average, which was also about a 50% retracement of the prior rally, immediately found support. Buy on dip traders came back and immediately punched it back to 52-week highs. And so we have the prevailing uptrend still quite intact. And the big question right now is, are we about to see that S&P 500 punching that 43 or 4400 on the upside and finally get another kind of 5% kick to the upside on the S&P? And while the S&P is doing that, really, I think the story is actually when looking under the hood in terms of what is driving this. And so it's on page 3 that I have that NASDAQ 100 chart. And while the S&P is toying with a breaking to a 52-week new high, what we can see here is that the NASDAQ has broken a 52-week high and has been staying up there over a week now as we see relative strength in the NASDAQ. And what's interesting about that is that where is that relative strength coming from within the NASDAQ? And that's in the FANG stocks. And so when looking at page 4, we can see that while the FANG stocks during that entire, since the start of the year, essentially have been materially underperforming, and while the cyclicals and financials have been roaring higher, almost all of those FANG stocks, everything from Apple to Amazon to Microsoft, have just been far more range-bound and chopping around. But what's really interesting in the last month is that we have seen these FANG stocks roaring, using this FANG index futures, up about 17% in the last month, and been the relative strength outperformer amongst the sectors. And that really is an interesting change of events, because ever since the reflation trade kicked in back in November, where almost all of the performance has been, at least outperformance, has been in being long financials and long cyclicals and long value. And what we really seen is that in the post-FOMC period, when we saw the yield curve get hammered and yields getting pressed down and a lot of these commodity markets turning over, suddenly, just like Harley Bassman was talking about these FANG stocks being like 70-year duration bonds, now when we see yields coming back down, it seems that there's rotation or sector rotation back into these kind of growth names. And this is one of the big questions to ask is, are we seeing this rotation now going to be a sustained new trend, or was it just these oversold conditions and suddenly this like a elastic that's been stretched too far? This is just like a reactionary snapback, or is this a bigger trend? And I think that's such a big puzzle piece to solve here in the coming weeks.
Patrick, we look a lot at the gold charts. Let's take a look more broadly at metals and mining, not just precious metals, but all metals and mining. That's represented by the XME ETF on page 5.
Right. And so this is where I really wanted to point out that what was working during this reflation trade and where the big question mark is that you can see that since November, this metal mining ETF has been just on a tear, up pretty much 100% since November. And really, you can see in the post-FOMC was the first legitimate sell-off that we had in a while. And similar to sell-offs that we saw in January and in March, almost immediately they got bought on dip and they quickly rallied back. And I think one of the biggest things that I'm watching into next week is that, was this a more meaningful change in trend, or was this a big buy on dip? And I don't know if I'm ready to stick my neck out definitively and make a bold call here, but it's really up to the bulls here to quickly recover this back up toward their highs to keep it going. A failure and continued consolidation in this space in the coming weeks will really start to solidify that some kind of bigger sector rotation has really gotten underway. And when we look at page 6, where I have the financials ETF, the XLF ETF, you can see the reaction was the same. The first initial highs on both the financials and on the metals and mining all came on those really high CPI prints. But really, when the FOMC took their hawkish tilt was where they all broke badly. And whether this is just a short-term noise and an overreaction, or whether it's a change in trend, is 100% the question I'm trying to solve.
Well, I'm going to give you my answer to that, which obviously is totally opinion and could be wrong. But as I look at almost all of these charts, whichever page, I'll just look at page 6 because it's in front of me right now. They all look the same to me. What I see is to the left of June 1st, I see a trend that's driven by the fact that most of the major governments around the world are in over their heads in a money printing experiment that is a no way out situation ultimately, but we're a long way from the final end game. And then I see for the last few weeks, a handful of people that were stupid enough to think that when they said they might tighten that they actually meant it this time. And it actually took the market down for a good whole couple of weeks before people came to their senses and realized that that's crazy and governments are going to continue to recklessly print and spend beyond their means just like they always have, which means that this reflation trade is going to continue. So if the reflation trade just ended because of the FOMC statement, I'm going to go double, triple, quadruple out on my out on a limb here and just say I'll be super duper wrong if it turns out that what really happened is the reflation trade is over because central bankers turned responsible and intend to stay that way. I don't buy that one.
Well, you know what? I certainly won't rule that out, but I'm gonna read the tape and see whether or not the price will be confirming your view. But let's move on to the dollar index on page 7 because I really wanted to visualize what we talked about in the market wrap at the beginning of the show. I mean, what we're really showing here is that since the start of that COVID period back in March 2020, there's been more or less an incredibly pronounced downtrend in the dollar. The dollar bear has really kind of very distinctly worked its way lower till the start of the year. But really, the last 6 months of 2021 has been far more of a sideways trade range rather than a downtrend. And this is why I think the dollar is going to give a big tell here. I mean, you are right that that kind of 89 to 94 zone is sort of one big trade range. And we've seen the highs and lows within there. And we're pretty much right in the dead center of that range. But will the dollar be able to muster up a more pronounced breakout out of this sideways trade range is one of the kind of big puzzle pieces to solve into the back half of the year.
Let's take a look at gold on page 8.
Yeah, really all I wanted to point out on gold here was just how distinct of a drop that was that happened last week. And really, while you know a lot of people are getting nervous about the gold trade very quickly, just on one quick bad break, but I think it's incredibly premature to be defining the next big trend move after that reaction. I think one of the key things I'm going to be watching for, I think gold can easily bounce to like 18 and a quarter to 18.50 on a reaction, but will there be a sustained buy on dip that develops here on gold, or does this turn into a distribution cycle that goes and retests those March and April lows? I think that the tell will come once we get a bounce, and we'll see how the bulls behave on that turn.
Well, needless to say, the technical analysis is the way to watch this, but if you want my gut feeling, I say gold goes down, 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 down until people who are not able to see the big picture, start to see the picture, come to their senses, and realize that gold needs to go up, 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 up. Not everybody, including really smart people who are good at details, understand big pictures, and I don't think most people get it. I really, really, really think that this is one of the best secular trades of our lifetimes, Patrick. The central bankers are going to make gold worth more, and people are going to get, I think, spooked out in the meantime thinking it's worth less, and that's just a great buying opportunity. So I'm crossing my fingers for lower numbers.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil on page 9. The one thing that I really wanted to highlight, because we're going to put up a chart here on copper, and we're going to put a chart up on lumber, and even, I don't have charts up here, but if you look at the grains or right across the entire commodity complex, we basically see crude oil still very distinctly in this bull trend higher. And it's an uninterrupted, very clear bull trend that remains in place. But other than the little quick pop we've seen on RBOB gasoline that joined the crude oil party on the upside, we really have seen the rest of the commodity complex correcting on the downside. And I asked the question, I mean, can crude oil, first of all, just kind of march to the beat of its own drum and really not play along with the the whole commodity complex? Or is crude oil just delaying on this? I mean, at this stage, the trend very distinctly points toward higher crude oil prices. But that divergence from the rest of the commodity complex leaves a big question as to what's next here. And I think that on the short term, I'll be watching whether or not the bulls can sustain these higher highs in crude oil in the coming days.
Patrick, let's move on to copper futures. I've been thinking about this one a lot. You know, the macro argument for why copper keeps going much higher is really strong. But boy, the argument for look how far it's already come, you know, new money buying new longs now kind of hard to justify, but I want to. What do you think?
Well, this is the interesting thing. Like the high of copper pretty much came in on that really hot CPI print and broke really badly on the FOMC. Now, the one thing that we can definitively say about copper is when it was near its highs, it was single-handedly the most consensus trade out there. I mean, finding anyone that was making a bearish copper argument, it was very, very hard to find anyone that would stick their neck out there. But what we really have seen now is a shift in the trend where typically you would see a buy on dip on copper, which should have came around 450, that broke quite definitively on the downside. Now, I don't want to already suggest that copper is going to do something outright bearish, but often these commodity cycles can last many, many months. And if we've seen kind of peak sentiment and peak short-term copper prices, the question here is are we seeing this not as a multi-week correction, but a multi-month correction? And if that's the case, will we temporarily see copper back under $4 to create another good buying opportunity down the road? So, you know, this is, again, just shows how many of these copper plays, including, you know, the copper has been pressured lower by China, at least verbally, you know, them talking about trying to bring these commodity prices back under control. It'll be interesting to see whether that will end up being a key high there. And another example of that is in lumber prices on page 11. You know, lumber was one of the most inflationary forces out there back throughout the first and going into the second quarter of the year. But after lumber just going parabolic to 1700 on the upside, I mean, this is as clear of a breakdown of that bull trend as you're going to get. I mean, we had a 50% wipeout in lumber prices in just 2 months off of those peak levels. And that just kind of shows just how divergent oil is from the rest of the commodity complex that has really already been distributing. And it'll be really interesting to see what the knock-on effects of this kind of a shift are. The one thing that I'm going to be watching for sure is if for whatever reason, if oil's given a catalyst to begin a correction, that could definitively turn the commodity index futures. Because when you look at something like the Bloomberg Commodity Index, it's so heavily weighted into the energy that the uptrend in those indices has been very distinctly higher, largely because oil's holding up. And this is why I think oil is going to be such an important market to watch here in the coming weeks.
Patrick, I don't mind admitting that where Treasury yields are headed has been a mystery to me. I don't believe in the meltdown scenario some people fear, but I don't know either. What do you think? Where are we headed, not just you know next week, but long term?
Well, it's interesting because the inflation theme has been so dominant. And while there's no denying it, I'm not trying to say that I'm against the inflation storyline. But what is interesting is how bonds no longer seem to be nervous about it. I mean, I've heard a number of people, whether on Twitter or some really smart guests, that have been talking about the decoupling of yields from inflation. And obviously, that's going to influence gold because of real yields. But one thing for sure is that we're now 3+ months into yields just consolidating and backfilling on the downside. And this has been doing it through some of the hottest inflation print numbers that we have seen in years. And I continue to think it's really interesting, and particularly on the hawkish tilt, if we go back to or go to page 13 when we're looking at the 5s-30s yield spread, you can really see, I mean, we wiped out 6 months of steepening on this curve. And what's interesting is you would think that we would at least get some sort of a meaningful reaction bullishly on the upside. And we find ourselves still trading very close to the bottom end of this range. And it really shows that the bond market is saying something different is happening here. And I'm just don't want to ignore this. I mean, definitely the bond market is taking the Fed a little more seriously than a lot of people who are trying to already say that it was just noise.
And listeners, don't forget, if you enjoy Patrick's chart decks, you don't have to wait for Macro Voices Thursday night. You can sign up for a free trial of Patrick's service, Big Picture Trading, and get a webinar with Patrick every single morning. You'll find information on page 14 or at bigpicturetrading.com. We're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better meet the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Abra Silver Resource Corporation, a premier emerging silver and gold exploration company, ticker ABRA on TSX Venture and ABBRF in the United States. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's Research Roundup.
This week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the chart book we just discussed in the post game. There's also a link to an article titled The Unintended Consequences of Punishing Big Oil, and a link to a Variant Perception article on capital gains tax, announcement effects, and sector rotation. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend, that's Eric spelt with a K, and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.